From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. OMG, time so flies. As of Friday, only 627 days remain until the 2020 presidential election, which means reporters, editors, anchors, and pundits are running out of time to speculate, trivialize, and marginalize, to be baited by irrelevancies, and to otherwise miss the forest for the clicks. But they've already got a head start. With at least a half dozen women in the running for the Democratic nomination, the media ether already abounds with nonsensical tropes.
Bernie's everything Warren is, but better. He's more energizing, more unifying, certainly more authentic.
Gillibrand is very politically ambitious. That's fine. She's without a doubt going to run for president.
The question really is, can a female win for president, but can a female beat Trump?
Scholars have long since established measurable biases and double standards in the perception of women holding and seeking power. But now, in the Me Too age and in the wake of the midterm elections' surge of women into the House of Representatives, the news media have a chance to choose new habits over old ones. And so we bring you this breaking news Consumer's Handbook, Gender and Politics edition. First on the list, the flawed and fraught metric of likeability.
The model of political leadership for a long time has been, do you want to have a beer with this presidential candidate? And that's a strange standard and one that probably ought to be interrogated, but it's also one that's not very available to high-achieving women who, for a variety of reasons, don't fit into that easygoing image, in large part because it's not available to them. And so because Hillary Clinton, I think, has been the main instance of what female political leadership could hypothetically look like in the United States, the fixation on her inability to fit into that paradigm of having a beer with the bros has sort of filtered into our concept of what a presidential candidate ought to be and can never be if she's female.
And yet, here was the first question that U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was asked as a presidential candidate.
I think a lot of people see you as pretty likable. How much is it a selling point, like an 80 fluence hour, Kirsten Gillibrand, that maybe the country wants someone like that now?
I think that actually invites the candidate to speculate in kind of a meta way about her own personality, which just instantly renders a person unlikable.
It's a trap. You know?
Yeah, it is a trap.
Now, almost by definition, candidates for public office as a group are ambitious and self-absorbed, sometimes to a pathological degree. But when a woman displays these traits, she somehow is Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, she certainly is. And if she's not, that's in some ways even more suspicious because it means that she's successfully masking it. I think Clinton kind of had it coming from both sides. She was both seen as conniving, calculating, secretive, and manipulative. But also, when there was nothing that could be said about, for example, abusing her staff, that too could be read as well. You know, she knew that she had to keep up the veneer, even in private contexts. You know, in other words, there is no way for female ambition, I think, to be read as straightforward, honest, and healthy.
Now, I almost hesitate to belabor the obvious, but there is also wardrobe fixation. Even if that's unusually blatant, the phenomenon of, you know, what does she look like? How is she dressed? It is always the elephant in the room.
I think what's very interesting about this moment and what gives me a lot of hope is that the midterm elections have produced this unprecedented abundance of women in the House, expanding our visual sense of what female leadership can look like and what the intersection between vanity, image, and political effectiveness can be.
Nonetheless, you still believe the culture is rigged against women. You've said that even popularity can redound against perceptions of seriousness. You talk about fandom and the double-edged sword that that represents.
We have so little practice relating to female political leaders that it sometimes slips over into the language of fandom, which I think is dangerous. Fandom is functionally, I think, diminishing to someone's perceived political seriousness. I will say that Ocasio-Cortez has been threading that needle in ways I find completely fascinating. She is young enough to have grown up being entirely fluent in the language of self-conscious self-presentation that older candidates sometimes falter at. She's managed to articulate a vision of female political leadership that is actually fun. She might be the female candidate that people do want to have a beer with. She's made that thinkable.
There was an episode where someone dug up the college YouTube video that they did, Dancing on a Rooftop. It was treated in the right-wing media as scandalous. She certainly flipped that to her advantage because people thought it was charming. There was a much more toxic example of using a woman's past against her, and that came with Kamala Harris.
For those of you who aren't familiar with our friend Kamala, let me give you just a little bit of background. She entered the California political scene in the early 90s. She was fresh out of law school and working at the Alameda County District Attorney's Office. Then enters her boo, Willie Brown. He was once the Speaker of the California State Assembly and Mayor of San Francisco. Over the weekend, the former San Fran mayor admitted to having an extramarital affair with young Kamala, pulling her out of obscurity and elevating her political career.
I think that it's just so clear that everyone who basically makes it up the ladder in politics has been helped in deeply inappropriate ways that I'm not sure that gendered smear is really taking root, which I was interested to observe. I don't know if you agree with that, but that was my sense.
You know, I think maybe there is reason for hope. But in the meantime, can we just look at the Amy Klobuchar situation? Evidently, she's a terrible boss. There's a lot of testimony to that effect. Berates employees, throws things, manages by humiliation, and so forth.
I am tough. I push people. That is true. But my point is that I have high expectations for myself. I have high expectations for the people that work for me. And I have high expectations for this country.
Now, temperament is, and always has been, fair game to evaluate candidates. Is this out of proportion to the way men are who fly off the handle?
I think that there is a real danger in calling any criticism of a female candidate sexist, not just because that's unfair and inappropriate, but because you also kneecap that candidate by making her seem fragile. To the extent that labor matters and that the rights of labor matter and that Democrats and those on the left prioritize human dignity in the workplace, those are pretty disqualifying traits. You know, I think those are entirely fair criticisms. I think, too, that playing into a pretty available stereotype of women as duplicitous, right? I mean, Klobuchar's reputation was as being very Minnesota nice. I mean, and, you know, in the Kavanaugh hearing, certainly she was a figure of apparent equanimity. So it's distressing, right, to find confirmation of something that I think is very easily attributed to other women. But if it's real, it's real. You know, I don't think there's anything to be gained by pretending that those things aren't true.
We've been talking about journalistic tropes. And, you know, one that certainly characterizes every race is horse race coverage, to ignore policy, to ignore the actual institutions of government, and just focus on electability. But even that seems to work to the disadvantage of female candidates, no?
What I think horse race coverage does is promote a tendency wherein the pundit ventriloquizes the worst aspects of American nature, so sexist, racist, etc., and then, taking all of that for granted, speculates on the chances of that voter overcoming all of those biases in order to elect a particular person. So that is always going to make female candidates, minority candidates, seem weaker and less electable for the simple reason that we have not historically elected people like that. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I think, where that has become the dominant mode of American reporting. Electability is the only relevant consideration. So it just produces a circle where there ought to be discussion of policy and what American people actually need.
This conversation is for a Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, which is our ongoing checklist of things for the media literate to keep their eyes open for, to understand that the media doing the reporting are doing them justice. But, you know, it may be actually a dubious premise, because it presumes that if journalists were just doing a little bit better, that we would be better able to be making sound, informed decisions. But in this case, it really isn't just flawed coverage. These are prejudices and double standards that afflict the entire culture. I wonder if the last checklist item on the consumer's handbook should be physician, heal thyself. You are responsible for what you bring to the table as well.
We believe ourselves to be rational consumers and rational actors, and I think we all like to think that we're fair-minded and weigh the evidence and make decisions accordingly. If cognitive science has shown us anything, it's that we are quite blind, in fact, to our own decision-making processes and very good at rationalizing our decisions after the fact. But often we're reconstructing a line of reasoning that isn't actually what led us to that conclusion. And that is hard to confront, and it is largely a function of bias, of implicit bias, but it's also the fact that first impressions have just been shown to enormously shape someone's idea of a person or a political issue. New facts don't actually cause us to refute those beliefs very often. It's not just that we're tribal, it's not just that partisanship is at an all-time high, it's that this is kind of like a flaw in the human brain, that, you know, that the need to collaborate and like link up with members of our tribe leads us to frequently overlook evidence that might, in a truly rational system, persuade us of the opposite case. So correcting for that is just an ongoing challenge. And I think requires, among other things, realizing the ways that we gravitate towards news coverage that confirms what we want to hear. And specifically, I think, horse race coverage that encourages us to think that our side will win.
Lily, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for chatting with me, Bob.
Lily Loofborough is a staff writer at Slate. You can view our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Gender and Politics edition, at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, depictions of the tabloid vixens of the 90s undergo some overdue revision.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The 90s imprinted certain images on our collective imaginations that we wholeheartedly embraced. Images about certain kinds of women, ambitious, raging women, who made salacious headlines a generation ago. Monica, Tanya, Lorena.
Monica was a young tramp.
Monica Lewinsky's behavior was unacceptable.
There's something about Monica.
Get rid of Nancy Kerrigan. Kill her now.
She felt the husband was selfish because he had an orgasm and she didn't. So she grabbed a handful and sliced. I mean, this was one angry woman.
But, and it may just be the passage of time, as our outdated tribal loyalties fade, we increasingly see how ill-served we were by our media and our biases, and we're finally able to peer through a clearer lens to consider information that was always there, but that we chose to ignore. First, Monica, the young intern who allegedly seduced a president and threatened a presidency.
Possible first line for Monica Lewinsky's new book, Me and My Big Mouth.
I think Monica Lewinsky is the one who should apologize to America. She's the homewrecker. And if anybody really owes an apology, I think it's her.
Today, David Letterman's joke is not funny, and Bill Maher's high dudgeon is even more puerile and self-serving than usual, in part because the woman herself, once a 22-year-old intern entranced by the leader of the free world, took time to grow up and speak on her own behalf. Here's part of her 2015 TED Talk, 2 years before the Me Too movement took off.
In 1998, after having been swept up into an improbable romance, I was then swept up into the eye of a political, legal, and media maelstrom like we had never seen before.
She spoke about how digital media turned an inevitable barrage into an epic global bombardment.
I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale almost instantaneously. In 1998, I lost my reputation and my dignity. I lost almost everything, and I almost lost my life.
Recently, her story was revisited in depth in the celebrated podcast Slow Burn.
Scared as she was on that Friday afternoon, Lewinsky was unwilling to get wired up and sent off to spy on the president.
That is where she comes through. I mean, as I can't imagine anybody else would, she just said no. I think there's an honesty, perhaps, under everything else that there is in the way Monica Lewinsky presents herself. She doesn't disguise herself. I just think that's admirable. I just persist in thinking that's admirable. She didn't do it.
With the passage of time, her tormentors, too, have been made to reflect.
Now, I started to feel bad because myself and other people with shows like this made relentless jokes about the poor woman.
Yes.
And she was a kid. She was 21, 22 or something.
She's 49.
I feel bad about my role in helping push the humiliation to the point of suffocation.
Had we, journalists, comedians, the general public, and yes, the supposedly enlightened liberals and feminists of the day, gotten Lewinsky wrong? What about Tanya Harding, the ruthless skater whose ex-husband hired someone to smash the knee of her competitor, Nancy Kerrigan?
My skating was great, but my life was in shambles.
She came from absolute nothing.
People called her poor white trash.
Tanya Harding was absolutely screwed over.
I get angry.
The villain of the 1994 Winter Olympics got an updated depiction with the 2018 documentary Truth and Lies, the Tanya Harding story, which portrayed her not simply as a vicious fighter, but as an abused girlfriend, an abused daughter, a perpetual outsider mocked relentlessly for her low class and pedigree, and who the Olympic Committee and the public were only too happy to watch fall from grace.
America, they want someone to love. Stars fading, but they want someone to hate. Still craving your kiss. And they want it easy.
This from I, Tanya, the biopic that also came out in 2017, rendering the once simple narrative even more complicated. Here, too, we didn't need new facts. We simply needed a new lens on an old story. And then, of course, there was Anita Hill, who in 1991 accused then-nominated Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. Hill might not have been universally condemned, but she was repeatedly humiliated. Take the November 1991 People magazine cover featuring Virginia and Clarence Thomas in an embrace with the headline, "How We Survived." Survived, that is, the allegations from the sex-crazed or love-struck clerk.
Are you a scorned woman? Do you have a martyr complex?
No, I don't.
Have you studied in your psychology studies when you were in school and what you may have followed up with the question of fantasies?
It looked bad then. It looks a lot worse now. That case, too, received a documentary revision and a docudramatic one on HBO, also before the Trump election and the subsequent Me Too movement. And as of this week, we can add one more woman and one more story to the list of the revisited and revised.
This was a modern love story. Boy meets girl. Boy falls in love with girl. Boy marries girl. Girl cuts off boy's penis.
Lorena Bobbitt, the aggrieved Manassas, Virginia wife who in 1993 cut off her husband's penis. As men held their collective groins, Lorena instantly became a national, no, a global joke.
It was December 22nd, 2016.
I was scrolling through Facebook and I saw a headline, a Huffington Post headline. It said, Lorena Bobbitt is done being your punchline.
Joshua Raffaele is the filmmaker behind Lorena, a four-part documentary series available now on Amazon Prime. He barely remembers when the story blew up.
I was 11 years old when this happened. But I grew up with this piece of ill-informed, perverse common knowledge that some crazed middle-aged white woman cut her husband's penis off in the middle of the night and threw it out the car window. When the reality is she had come here at age 18 from Venezuela in search of the American dream, and she thought she found it when she met this handsome, charming Marine named John Wayne, John Wayne Bobbitt.
The story was called The Battle of the Bobbitts, which made it seem roughly as if they were two equals.
This goes to show the weight that was given to what she did to him as opposed to what he had done to her over and over again, serially abusing and raping her for years. Her one act was given the same weight as his 4 years worth of acts.
And I was thinking that if you were to render the story in cartoon form, the main character was just really a severed part of one Bobbitt. The story followed how it was detached, where it was thrown, how it was found, whether it still worked.
It's a really uncommon injury. I've never done one, never seen one.
Will he ever, ever have a normal sex life again?
I'm optimistic that he'll regain virtually all of his normal function.
And most important, what some tabloids, quoting Shakespeare, called the unkindest cut of all, did it hurt? It was about a penis.
It was all anybody cared about.
Which reminds me that at this point in time, respectable publications and news outlets didn't use the word penis.
In the beginning of episode one, one of the police officers talks about having to get onto the radio and try to convey to the other officers what the situation was. They were all speaking in vague terms about a missing appendage. And some of the police officers thought that, is this a finger? Is this a toe? What are we looking for?
What were the mores of the time that were shaping the coverage?
If you go back just a couple of years before Lorena's story hit, and we do this in episode one, we take you back to Anita Hill and the William Kennedy Smith rape trial, the Tailhook scandal. And in every instance, any time that a woman or a group of women, in the case of Tailhook, came forward and expressed clearly that they had been harassed or assaulted in a sexual nature, and they were discredited, vilified, the justice system turned its back on them, it was without fail a losing proposition for a woman who was coming forward. And so in 1993, when this young girl named Lorena Bobbitt is now in the middle of all of this, she really didn't stand a chance.
And sketching the media landscape, cable TV was blooming, and prominent among the proliferating channels was Court TV.
This story in many ways was the original clickbait. It had the ultimate headline. Once that headline about a severed penis grabbed everybody's attention, there was this moral misstep, which was keep the headlines on the penis. The media is absolutely complicit in the misrepresentation of this story. This is a story not about a cut-off penis. This is a story about a woman who was beaten, she was strangled, she was raped, she was sodomized, and it went on for years.
From your footage, it didn't seem like the attitudes towards Lorena were universally condemning. There was an interesting exchange between Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters on their popular show.
I do think that men and women see this very differently. And men see it as a man being mutilated, I think, in the most awful way a man can imagine. Many women see it as a woman abused to such a degree that she struck out at the area that was doing her the most harm.
You can still be very sensitive to the need to cut down on abuse of women and see this act as different from the act of many women who are abused. Who may kill their husband.
If you're a man, you may. And you are.
I guess I can't help looking at it that way.
To me, one of the most interesting things in terms of the archival footage that we found was the sort of man and woman on the street interviews that shows like Jenny Jones or even the Nightly News would do. And there were a number of women who did not think that even if she was raped, that there was any excuse.
that. No.
I think she did it so he wouldn't have sex with anyone else. I think that was the real reason why she did it.
Some of them just flat out didn't believe her. That said, there were also many women who did believe her.
I would have liked to do that.
You would have?
Huh? Yes. Yes, if I was raped or wrong, of course that's your first feeling, to get back at somebody.
Many women in the media at the time, they were trying to write the stories that would have propped Lorena up more as what she was, but the editors were men. You see the cover of Time magazine from during Lorena's trial, and it's a pig in a business suit, and the headline is, "Are Men Really That Bad?" And that is in response to this woman who was on the stand having a panic attack, telling you of the way she was beaten, raped, and sodomized.
A 1993 op-ed in the LA Times by Robin Abkarian argued that to make Lorena Bobbitt into a symbol for anything other than a sick marriage between two immature, angry people is to compromise the legitimacy that has finally been conferred on battered women who strike back in self-defense.
Battered women syndrome, as it was starting to become known, was a new phenomenon. And so, you know, I think part of this is about class and race. If Lorena had been a white, rich woman from an affluent area, I don't think that she would have been categorized as that piece in the LA Times categorized her.
In January of 1994, Nancy Kerrigan was assaulted in Detroit, and the media had a new tabloid story to focus on, the saga of Tonya Harding. And because of the short attention span, some important moments in the Bobbitt story were missed. How John beat his next two partners. And this.
John forcibly took me out onto the balcony and pushed me over the edge of the balcony and was holding on to me by my lower legs, dangling me over the balcony, threatening to drop me.
Would a longer gaze on this story have led to a different assessment?
Impossible to say, I think, but we were not out to unearth anything. It was all there 25 years ago in plain sight. Just a fresh perspective and having the facts contextualized as they should have been in the first place was all it would take.
So many strange details that I didn't know. The pictures that were available of her abuse. John Wayne Bobbitt's bald face lying in the face of indisputable evidence. The rush to judging from people from whom I would have expected much better than this, given what was available. It was like a collective blindness. For the series, you talked to journalists and activists and nurses and doctors and lawyers who were present for the original story. You talked to Lorena. You talk to John. You don't talk to Howard Stern.
I tried to.
Yeah?
Listen, we wanted to talk to Howard Stern. We wanted to talk to Charlie Rose. We wanted to talk to Matt Lauer. We wanted to talk to Geraldo Rivera.
She felt the husband was selfish because he had an orgasm and she didn't. So she grabbed a handful and sliced. I mean, this was one angry woman.
Howard Stern aside, those other guys were exposed for predatory behavior. And so I'm actually glad, obviously, that they were exposed. But had they never been exposed and we interviewed them, all they would have given us is their forward-facing, you know, line of BS. Looking at the series and seeing them just in there, being the ones who are reporting the news to us, speaks far more than anything they would have said to us. Mm-hmm. That would have been disingenuous anyway.
Howard Stern, though, did go some distance in turning
Despicable.
John Wayne Bobbitt into a star.
So during Lorena's trial, again, while it is so clear that she has been abused by him, it's even been corroborated by a piece of paper that he had signed admitting to abusing her.
Not to mention all the neighbors who saw it.
Many, many people. John Wayne called into the Howard Stern show.
I don't even buy this whole thing that he was raping her and stuff. Like, she's, you know, she's not that great looking. She's got a lot of pimples, your ex-wife.
Yeah.
I thought so. Her skin didn't look that good. I think she needs a little vitamin Bobbitt.
Oh,
I would ask him what he was thinking back then. Had he not heard and seen everything that was clearly available? And I would ask him what he has to say today. does he feel any sort of remorse for speaking about somebody who was a victim of such horrors in such a despicable way?
You know, Jordan Peele is the executive producer of this film. I'm curious how he got into that position. If you could tell me a little bit about what his expectations were.
Well, Jordan and I met in, God, I think it was October of 2013 at a screening of my first documentary. It's called Lost for Life, and it's about juveniles who are serving life without parole. And he expressed really loving the film, and so we connected and we became friends. We'd have these weekly excursions to go get Chinese food where we would talk about work and life and whatever.
And this is before Get Out.
This is well before Get Out. And then it was January of 2017 when Lorena had agreed to do this project with me that during one of those Chinese food excursions, I said, you're never going to guess who I'm making my next project about, Lorena Bobbitt. And he right away was fascinated and had a million questions and admittedly had the same preconceived notions that I had had, that all of us had had. And this is now leading up to Get Out being released. And every time I saw him, all he wanted to talk about or ask about was this project. He couldn't believe how many layers there were to it, how much depth there was, how you know, he hoped that maybe telling a story about gender and sexual assault and domestic violence, that maybe this could do for that, what the OJ doc series could do in its examination of race. And it was literally Get Out opening weekend that he just turned to me and he said, what's going on with the Bobbitt Project? That he'd love to be a part of it.
It's interesting because the media have been such a double-edged sword for Lorena. I mean, since her trial, she's used the media to advocate for battered women. It's given her life a direction. She's willing to tolerate or cut through the jokes to make the most of any platform that she can get, like on the Steve Harvey Show.
What made you take it, though? I mean, you cut it off. Why you leave with it? That's what I
know.
You didn't think it just like lay it on a pillow so when you wake up?
Well, I'm glad that after 22 years you still laugh about it. I'm here to tell you and to tell everyone what happened when a woman gets abused by a man.
Most people whose lives the media chew up and spit out aren't able to emerge with this kind of strength and agency. Why do you think she was able to do it?
I truly don't know. Her level of resilience is unlike any I've ever seen. It's not only that she was able to make it through this and claim for herself the life that she dreamed of having, which, by the way, is just a simple, quiet life. She didn't want anything extraordinary. She didn't want anybody to know her name. She just wanted to, in her own words, live the American dream. Coming here, finding an honest job, falling in love, having a family, end of story. That's all she wanted. First, John Wayne Bobbitt ripped that from her, and then the media and the American people and the world at large continued to pull that even further and further away from her. And yet still, she was unstoppable. She got it. And that's an extraordinary feat in and of itself. But to me, the thing that is perhaps even more amazing is she's still just so, her spirit has not been destroyed. There's a purity and a levity to her that I don't know how she's able to possess those things in light of everything that's happened.
The series ends on a pretty bleak note.
If Lorena's story hit today, Fox News would take the place of Howard Stern. And the 24-hour news cycle would focus on what she did rather than what he did.
Why do you assume that we, the media, and we, the public, wouldn't process these events differently now?
I think that we still see a great rush to judgment. I think that we can see somebody's life sort of torn apart by a tweet that runs wild for a couple of hours. I think that even though we are finally talking about all of these issues, there are so many victims of domestic violence and sexual violence that continue to suffer. That far outweighs, unfortunately, any progress that we've made. And so people can read into the ending, you know, however they'd like, but I think that it should be a challenge to us all to make sure we do better and to try and bring empathy forward as the thing we use to appraise a situation. The ending of the series is the phone number for the National Domestic Violence Hotline. That was something that was important to us. It was something that was important to Lorena. That is the way Lorena has gotten the last word. We are making it very clear that's what this is about. This is for the victims.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Joshua Roffe directed Lorena, available now on Amazon Prime. I spoke with Lorena, who goes now by Lorena Gallo, about how she's worked to take control of her own story and redirect the media attention onto a national epidemic.
At first, it was very difficult, but since I've been an advocate against domestic violence, listening to the stories of survivors, the victims who are trying to leave, but they're not there yet, that gave me strength. That gave me more courage to tell my story, to do this documentary. Basically, my story, I share it with a lot of people within my community because I go to the shelters and I volunteer. And as an advocate, I know I have a voice, and my goal is to reach out to the victim and the survivors too, because, you know, survivors go through post-traumatic stress disorders as well. It really ignited fire on me on telling and retelling my story, because there is hope and there is help.
After you were acquitted of malicious wounding, you didn't want to go to the hospital as the law required. But in the end, you were glad you did?
Yes. I was confused. I didn't know where they were taking me when I, you know, heard that I was acquitted by temporary insanity. I want to go home. I felt that John should have been there. You know, he was an abuser. He needed to be treated. But
it did help you.
I don't know if it helped me so much because they were questioning me. I just finished incredibly, you know, emotionally and traumatic interrogation, which was the trial. Two trials, actually, his trial and my trial, my own. And then I was questioning again and again and again. And it seems like it didn't stop. But in terms of being quiet and taking care of my own self, it was the start of the healing process, yeah.
So as we follow your path, you see people who you relied on as friends taking advantage of you. You realize that your parents weren't really in a position to help and became another responsibility when they came to America. The pressures didn't cease, obviously, after you left the hospital. Was there a moment when you just said, enough, this is my life, and I will choose to tell it when I choose and how I choose?
From the moment I felt that I wasn't alone, I felt security in going to shelters and sharing the stories. So the more I talk, the more I wanted the whole world to actually know what happened. And I started telling the story, but it wasn't enough. My whole story, when it first came out 25 years ago, it reached out so wrongly. I felt like the media failed me, the justice system failed me, I felt that society failed me. And I know that if I'm going to tell my story again and feel justified, even though if I go to a comedian's show, I didn't mind the jokes anymore. As long as I shine the light on domestic abuse and make an awareness against domestic violence, then my mission is a noble mission. And, you know, basically I grew stronger and stronger, and it made me the person that I am today. And I didn't let that or anybody or even John define who I am.
Lorena, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, and also thank you for the opportunity to let me talk about the documentary. I think we're going to help a lot of victims just to bring awareness. This is such an incredible opportunity.
That was Lorena Bobbitt, who now goes by Lorena Gallo, who's the focus of a documentary called Lorena, available now on Amazon Prime.
Coming up, Black History Month is not what it was supposed to be.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. February is Black History Month, which explains the latest national celebration of Frederick Douglass, George Washington Carver, Harriet Tubman, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and not a whole lot else. Proclaimed by President Gerald Ford in 1976, it was an outgrowth of Harvard educator Carter G. Woodson's 1926 initiative, Negro History Week. But if Black History Month has expanded the original by a factor of four, maybe it has also shrunken it. Social critic Doreen St. Felix wrote on the subject last February in The New Yorker. We spoke to her then, and she told us that the focus on a handful of familiar faces obscures the true measure and the vital lessons of Black history.
Black History Month, having been something that was established a little over 40 years ago, we've seen that it's very quickly taken on this character where we pay lip service to very recognizable and often strictly political Black figures. There's not really an effort to make anything more than shallow inquiries into what we might call the breadth of Black American history.
The George Washington Carverization of Black history.
Exactly.
I refer, of course, to the only African-American scientist who ever lived, who famously came up with 133 uses for the peanut, which is not nothing, but perhaps maybe overemphasized.
It's, of course, very significant that George Washington Carver was a scientist and a food anthropologist when he was, and he made many advancements into the way that the American diet actually exists today. He was one of the first people who figured out recipes for pressing nuts into milk, and we're in that fever right now. You know, everybody's like trying to find another kind of milk alternative, and this was someone who anticipated that nearly a century ago. But what happens is when students are taught that someone like George Washington Carver is a saint of Black history, there's a strange political frame that emerges. Someone like Carver is overemphasized because he doesn't seem dangerous. And that's why his work with the peanut is always emphasized. George Washington Carver was actually someone who advocated for Black farmers in the South. But that's not something that you hear because, of course, then a suite of questions ensue. Why were these Americans poor? And then you start talking about Jim Crow, and that's not something that is really encouraged in our general conversations.
On the other hand, as it was originally conceived, at least by Gerald Ford, I suppose, to inspire pride and understanding of shared Black history and distinct Black history in the United States, it's not entirely useless. Has it met its principal goal?
It is important, and it does affect students of all races to learn that there have been great Black American figures. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to remain vigilant about how certain narratives are being flattened and being commercialized often. For anyone who was watching the Super Bowl, you might have seen that commercial.
The Dodge Ram truck commercial featuring Martin Luther King Jr.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant.
For those of us who feel very sensitive to the commercialization of his legacy, it's heartbreaking. Watching a game that has brutalized so many men, and many of those men being Black, and then again seeing a commercial that completely decontextualizes the agenda of a figure like Martin Luther King Jr. His socialism is something that is like just not mentioned at all during this month, or not mentioned at all during Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which happens the month before. So you're always in this really tenuous spot when you recognize that whatever we get is good, right? Because we get so little, but at the same time, we always want to be pushing for more and for higher quality education.
There are those, and I am right now thinking of Morgan Freeman, the actor, who think that any effort to discriminate between the American black experience and American history altogether is itself a mistake. Here he is in a conversation with the late Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes.
Black History Month, you find ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Come on. Tell me.
Well, I'm Jewish.
Okay. Which month is Jewish History Month?
There isn't one.
Oh. Oh. Why not?
Yeah.
Do you want one?
No.
I don't either.
So this interview has definitely entered the lore in terms of cantankerous old black people and their opinions. Obviously, what Freeman is saying, it has a grain of truth. Black history is not something that can be relegated to a month.
What he's describing is segregated history.
And that's how he sees it. Of course, there are people like myself who find problems with Black History Month, but don't necessarily see it as like a segregationist exercise. It originated in the work of Carter G. Woodson, who was the second black person to receive a doctorate from Harvard after, of course, the father of black history, Du Bois. When he and his colleagues were building journals of African American history, when they were establishing associations, what they were discussing was that a subjugated people needs to have its history in order to assert its identity within the present. And that's, I think, a very radical political notion that has proceeded from the way that we think of Black History Month.
Whether it's George Washington and the cherry tree, or Lincoln freeing the slaves, or ask not what your country can do for you, we don't typically consume any part of our history in the most sophisticated and multidimensional form. Is there something peculiar about Black History Month that makes it more trivialized than the rest of the country's history?
I think absolutely. And that is, to be crude, it is the forces of racism and how they have contributed to the way historiography works in America. So one of the clearest examples I actually experienced this year in terms of how Black history is like purposefully shaped would be the case of Recy Taylor. Oprah mentioned her during the Golden Globes Awards speech.
When she was abducted by 6 armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice.
And Rosa Parks is someone that we have a high familiarity with her social contributions, right? But this story didn't really fit with the kind of like iconic image of her deciding that she was not going to get off her seat in the bus. It's not something that we can fit into acceptable narratives or like etiquette of how we actually think civil rights happened.
Should instead of George Washington Carver, we be seeing Recy Taylor? Should we be seeing Medgar Evers, Emmett Till, Malcolm X? Is the main problem here not what is presented, but what is not presented?
I think that's definitely a place to begin, but I think also something that needs to be emphasized is a sense of movements in Black history. Because we emphasize so much individual figures, we don't have a sense of the communities that they've actually come from.
Doreen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Doreen St. Felix is a staff writer at The New Yorker. I spoke with her in February 2018. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Oster Chetivetti. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.